From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Detroit Emergency Manager Kevin Orr heads to Lansing, pleading for state aid to help the city out of bankruptcy.
He said, we need state money to get this done, and he laid out what would happen if the state money didn't come through.
Michigan is running out of money to lend to schools in financial distress. Now what?
The concern is, you know, why are we continuing to go back to the fund, and what does that say about the health of the fiscal health of the state school district?
And are we becoming less dependent on our cars?
Before 1900, nobody had a car. The auto industry's dominance in this country is only kind of a recent phenomenon.
Plus, we track the long history of the authentic urban experience of Detroit's Eastern Market. Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Things aren't going so hot when it comes to school finances in Michigan. The state has basically run out of money to loan to struggling schools. The reason? Because so many districts need help. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's Stateside, we'll hear how we got to this point and what can be done to change the way schools use and receive state funds. Then, young people are not only driving less than teens did a generation ago, they aren't even bothering to get their licenses. We'll find out what driving less means for the auto industry and the future of how we get around. But first, Detroit Emergency Manager Kevin Orr was in Lansing today. He testified before the newly formed House Committee on Detroit's Recovery and Michigan's Future.
We have an ambitious schedule. We have what we think is a reasonable plan. But to put it bluntly, we need your money.
That House committee begins debate on the package of 11 bills that would have the state contributing somewhere around $195 million to the city. With Detroit's bankruptcy heading toward a July trial, state lawmakers are fast-tracking these bills. They hope to get measures to the House floor for a vote as early as next week, and then onto the governor's desk by early June. MLive Capitol reporter Jonathan Osting was at today's session in Lansing. Jonathan, just how did Kevin Orr make his case to this House committee?
Well, he made his case with a lot of PowerPoint slides, charts, a red laser pointer, and some pretty blunt words, really. He laid it out. He said, we need state money to get this done. And he laid out what would happen if the state money didn't come through. He said that the $366 million pledged by foundations, the $100 million from the DIA, those would disappear without all that outside money. He said pensioners would face much more significant cuts. The DIA artwork could be vulnerable to a potential fire sale that would benefit creditors as well as pensioners. It wouldn't mitigate pension cuts as much as this package would. So he gave what I'd consider a hard sell to that.
And how was the room? What was the response from lawmakers?
It's a small panel. It's not everybody in the legislature.
Sure.
I think the panel is probably picked to avoid some of the most reactionary lawmakers. So there were a lot of questions, certainly. I mean, that's, he testified for something like 20 minutes, and then there was another 20 to 30 minutes of questions. So there's a lot of interest, a lot of details. This is a big package. They were talking about 10 bills today, but there's an 11th as well. So there's a lot of moving parts here. And lawmakers that I talked to afterwards, many of them said they're not ready to endorse the deal one way or another because they still have more questions, and they're going to continue hearings tomorrow and Thursday.
Who else is going to be up to testify when you're looking down the week and in front of this committee?
Sure. Well, Representative Walsh is chairing the committee, said that Mayor Duggan is going to be in town either later this week or early next and could potentially testify. Tomorrow, it's going to be groups with any interest in the case. So I imagine that's going to be unions, et cetera, who are going to come and share their thoughts on the deal. Thursday is going to be a day for public testimony. They actually did not allow for public testimony tomorrow and are planning to Wednesday as well. They're trying to save that all for one day to, as Walsh said, allow lawmakers to go home and consider those comments over the weekend.
Was there anything that surprised you in terms of either Kevin Orr's testimony or questions and statements from the lawmakers?
Like I mentioned, I think Orr definitely did a stronger sales pitch than we've ever heard from him before. A couple weeks ago, he was in town, and he said he was basically just explaining the city's plan of adjustment to lawmakers and said he wasn't really trying to convince them one way or another. That wasn't the case today. He was pretty clear, that he was there. At one point, he said begging for money. So he didn't try and sugarcoat it this time around. Other surprises, I think that, some of the Dems on the panel have expressed some concern, I guess it's not surprising, but about the oversight commission. This legislation would set up a seven-member body that would have broad power over state financial decisions for 20 years, possibly longer. A lot of the Detroit Dems really want to know more about what that would look like and have concerns there.
There was an interesting, I saw something on Twitter that Orr called himself public enemy number two and said, you can guess who number one is?
Yeah, that's right. That was a joke. He was talking about litigation. This bill would also basically take the state off the hook for any litigation relating to the bankruptcy case or the emergency manager law that was used to sort of start the process. Or made reference to the fact that people upset by this deal have already filed suits against the city himself and the state. He was clearly referencing Governor Rick Snyder there when he talked about other potential lawsuits that could come down the pipeline. So that's another selling point of this deal for some skeptical lawmakers, is that by approving state money for Detroit, the state would be off the hook for a lot of legal bills potentially down the line.
And the bottom line, though, is, as Orr put it, to put it bluntly, we need your money.
Exactly. The creditors are starting to vote on this deal already. They haven't until July 11th to do so. And Orr said they're unlikely to approve the deal without the state money, and that could have a significant effect on the process. He said essentially it could send them back to the drawing board on the Detroit bankruptcy case.
Jonathan Osting, MLive's Capitol correspondent, checking in on Kevin Orr's testimony this morning in Lansing. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Hey, thank you for having me.
New polling just released this morning sheds some light into how folks who live outside of Detroit feel about this possible settlement, about money going from Lansing to Detroit. As part of the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, Michigan Radio's Lester Graham and Sarah Swick have been poring over the results of our Epic MRA poll. And Lester, the first question that was asked was something along the lines of, would you be in favor of the state giving Detroit $350 million to provide assistance for the financial recovery of the city? What did you find?
Well, keep in mind, these are people not in Detroit, the rest of the state. And 49% were in favor of that, 34% opposed. So that's a plurality. That's a lot bigger chunk of folks than we thought.
But now there was this kind of interesting dynamic when you would explain to people that the money would go to shore up the retiree pension funds and protect the works at the DIA. What happened then?
Well, what happens then is people really like the plan even more because they know where the money's going. They know what it's going to be helping, and they appreciate that the retirees worked hard. They deserve their pensions or as much of it as can be saved through bankruptcy, and they appreciate the art. So 62% of people, again, people in Michigan outside of Detroit, are in favor of that $350 million for Detroit.
And that's a hefty majority.
That's a good-sized majority,
and
yeah.
And Sarah, this was across the board, politically speaking, right?
Yeah, it seems that way. I think that you do see, when you look at questions like about, who is at fault for Detroit's situation, and when you look at, overall, Democrats seem somewhat more likely to support this. I guess I'd say this anecdotally as well, but it's pretty much across the board spectrum politically, as far as we can tell.
Yeah, that 62% support, when you start breaking it down by party or by political belief, 74% of the Democrats, 58% of the Republicans, and about 51% of the independents. So I think that's the line Cynthia was looking for.
Right. Lester, how do you think this survey should be interpreted, let's say, by the lawmakers who are going to be voting on this package of 11 bills to aid Detroit?
Well, conventional wisdom is they don't want to be seen as doing the outstate legislators, don't want to be seen as doing anything that looks like a bailout for Detroit.
Yes.
Now, when people understand this better, and it only takes a second to explain it to them a little better, mm-hmm. they're in favor of the idea. So one of the things we wanted to find out is, do these people, do these voters in outstate Michigan and in the suburbs, would they find fault with their legislator, vote against them in the next election because of this? And quite frankly, most of them said, 55% of them said, it doesn't make any difference. I wouldn't change my vote on somebody just because of this one thing. 27% indicated they'd be more likely to vote for a legislator who voted for this $350 million for Detroit. And only 15% said they'd be less likely to vote for a legislator. Now, keep in mind, that 15% in a primary election might make a real difference.
Right.
But we don't know whether they're, you know, we're talking about general election here. Our pollster, Bernie Porn at Epic MRA, says he doesn't think that this is going to negatively impact legislators at all running for a reelection.
Sarah, what most surprised you by the results of this poll?
I think the rather overwhelming majorities, or I guess pluralities when you ask the question in a certain way, but that most people outside of Detroit really, really seem to have a sense that Detroit is very important to the state and that the state should help it. I mean, it's been, I think those of us in the media for a while have been repeating this idea that outstate legislators are really opposed to helping out Detroit because they would be punished by their voters. Well, it turns out that that probably isn't really true. It's not clear to me whether people's minds are being changed as the bankruptcy progresses and as they find out more information about what this grand bargain actually consists of, or whether all along, you know, this people have been saying, well, we should support Detroit, even though, you know, they've made mistakes in the past. Detroit is important to the state, and we need to help them, especially to help the pensioners.
Surprise for you, Lester?
Yeah, it was. You know, I think part of the reason why we were under this impression, conventional wisdom was that outstate folks wouldn't like it, is simply because those who didn't like were really loud about the fact that they didn't want state tax dollars to go to Detroit. So, you know, it's one of those cases, if you're the loudest one in the room, sometimes you get all the attention. It doesn't mean that you have the majority feelings.
Michigan Radio's Lester Graham and Sarah Swick looking at new polling by Michigan Radio and the Detroit Journalism Cooperative. Polling that looks at how Michiganders who do not live in Detroit feel about state money going to Detroit. You can see more details of the poll and find all of our Detroit coverage at MichiganRadio.org. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As emergency sirens screeched across much of southeast Michigan yesterday due to severe weather with thunderstorm and tornado warnings, a lot of schools were just letting the kids out for the day, and that led some parents to wonder, what's being done with my kid? Greg Gray is superintendent of Brighton Area Schools. They got some heavy storms yesterday afternoon. Hello, Greg.
How you doing, Cindy?
I'm great. So flesh this out for us. School is ending, and then there's that kind of gray area between classes not in session and kids waiting for rides and buses. So what do you as the school do in that situation during severe weather?
Well, I think you have a general set of parameters that you go with, and you have policies in place, but it's always a little different, and there's always a little different spin on it. Like yesterday, we still had some high school kids and some middle school kids on our buses as the sirens went off. So we had to direct our buses to the nearest school, and we had principals still there that directed them as soon as they got there as quickly as we could to a safe and secure location. The other schools were approximately 5 to 30 minutes from releasing on the day. So we had to also act quickly in relation to that to get kids into locations that, again, we're going to be as safe as possible during that inclement weather.
So you have to be very fluid and very quick to respond.
You do. You do. And at the same time, you have to be cognizant that the parents are going to want to know what's happening, because I'm sure they have the alarms on their phones as well. And they know that we're under a severe weather issue, such as yesterday with the tornado warning. So at the same time, while we're directing busing and principals and kids into locations, we're crafting communications that we send via mass communication tools to our parents, just so we can, you know, kind of ease their anxiety that their kids are safe and they're well taken care of.
You have to be grateful for social media and mass text messaging, as opposed to what I remember from my days in school or when my kids were in school, the telephone chain.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's helped. You know, the only thing I would say is that at times it can hurt as well if misinformation gets out. So
sure.
We try to be very, very deliberate in our communications, and we only use those mass communication tools from my office in very, very serious situations, because if we send out too many, I think people stop listening.
Is there a standardized state policy, or how does that work as you look across the state at all the districts?
You know, most of the districts follow similar policies because they're best practice. We have a policy-making firm that does a majority of the policy across the state of Michigan in terms of board policy, and we follow state rules and regulations. We also have disaster drills, 10 of them that are mandated by the state each year, which include tornado warning issues and other inclement weather type situations. And so we've practiced this. We have the policies in place that we utilize in terms of this, and we're always looking to our local fire and police chiefs to give us the latest and greatest in terms of keeping our kids safe.
And so how'd the kids do yesterday? How'd everyone handle it?
You know, I was so impressed with our kids. They handled it really well. It's a long time to sit in the hallway for almost 2 hours. And I would say our staff was also fantastic. You know, they all jumped right in. They kept our kids comfortable and quiet and engaged. Some read books. You know, I'll tell you, probably the best case was at one of my elementaries. I had a junior kindergarten class of five-year-olds that were so relaxed that three or four of them fell asleep. So I think we handled it real well, and I think our kids were, you know, never thought that they were in any type of threat.
Greg Gray, superintendent of the Brighton Area Schools, and hopefully a more peaceful ending to school over today and the next few days, Greg. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
There is a state law that gives a special board up to $50 million, money that can be loaned to struggling school districts. The long-term, low-interest loans are supposed to help these districts restructure and pay down their debt. Well, here's the problem. This emergency loan board has already given out $48 million. That is 97% of the money that was supposed to last until not the end of this year, not the end of next year, but until 2018. So how did this happen? And is there a way for struggling school districts to get back on their feet without needing an emergency manager or having to ask for another loan? Jeff Guilfoyle is with Public Sector Consultants. Good to have you with us, Jeff.
Oh, thank you.
So that emergency loan fund was supposed to last until 2018?
The emergency loan fund, I think, has been taxed because we've seen a lot of school districts and local governments get into trouble. And, you know, it only takes one or two big loans, and you can get there pretty quickly. The governor's executive budget recommendation recommended adding an additional $50 million to the fund. So I think it is the fact that you're seeing that fund tapped pretty regularly is symptomatic of the fiscal pressure that we're seeing across the state and our local governments and school districts.
But I get a sense when it was being set up, I don't think anyone expected that so many schools would be in such deep financial distress at pretty much the same time.
You know, school districts in Michigan are under a pretty significant amount of fiscal stress. They're facing both declining resources that are heading to the classrooms. If you look at how much money they're getting per pupil and you adjust it for inflation, that number has been declining, particularly if you account for the amount of money that traditional school districts have to send to support the school retirement system. So if you go back about 10 years, they were sending roughly 13% of their payroll to support retirement costs. And now that number is closer to a third of their payroll. Mm. So that's a pretty significant drain on the resources they have available to them. And then the foundation allowance hasn't been keeping up with inflation either. But even beyond the per pupil amount, what we've seen is a fairly significant decline in enrollment across the state, primarily for demographic reasons, although, you know, the expansion of charter schools contributes to that as well.
Sure.
And it's very difficult for school districts to manage their finances when they're faced with declining enrollment. And so the combination of the sort of smaller per pupil amounts and the pressure of declining enrollment is putting a really significant fiscal strain on the state's district.
And then here we go, something that we're hearing all over when we talk about municipalities, too, these retirement costs.
Yes, yeah. The one big difference between school districts and municipalities with retirement costs is that there's one statewide system for all the traditional schools where all the local governments, for the most part, have the choice over what system they want to use. So school districts can't really make decisions to sort of opt out of the state retirement system or, you know, switch over to a 401k. We did back in 2012 make fairly significant changes to the state's retirement system for schools that's going to lead to a dramatic reduction in those retirement costs. The problem is what we're paying for right now are legacy costs that we've accumulated over the years. And so you don't really see the savings from the new law for a pretty extended period.
I'm speaking with Jeff Guilfoyle of Public Sector Consultants as we look at the fact that Michigan's running out of money to lend to schools in financial distress. And just kind of running down this list of Michigan school districts that have gotten emergency loans, I'm going to go up the list from smallest to largest size loans. You've got Buena Vista Schools, $2 million, Benton Harbor Area Schools, $4 million, Highland Park School District, $7.41 million, Pontiac Schools got $10 million, Inkster over $12 million, and Muskegon Heights, $12.55 million. Now, we know two of these districts, Inkster and Buena Vista, have been dissolved. But give us a sense of what this money was used for, Jeff.
Before the school districts are taken over by the state, I mean, they, you know, a lot of times have run a significant ongoing deficit that's accumulated over a number of years. And at some point, they reach a situation where, given the size of their deficit, they struggle to with cash flow problems. So they struggle to make payroll, or they struggle to pay the retirement costs to the state, or just, you know, pay their vendors. Mm-hmm. And so they need an infusion of cash to sort of move them forward. And I think, you know, when you look at that list of schools, you know, these were all sort of urban districts that, you know, traditionally were fairly low performing on a test score standpoint, who saw significant enrollment declines. And I think that a lot of times if you're a district, you know, like I say, two-thirds of the state's districts are losing enrollment right now for demographic reasons. But if you're a district that sees very large enrollment declines, particularly due to school of choice, so if you're a district where maybe you've been struggling and so the parents in that district are looking for other opportunities for their children and pulling their kids out,
sure,
you can quickly find yourself in a situation where it's virtually impossible to balance your budget.
Well, when we look at across the state, Jeff, how many more districts do you think are in danger of needing emergency cash from the state?
So, you know, when I look at the finances of school districts, you know, I am concerned about the districts that sort of reach that crisis point and need emergency financing from the state. But I think the broader question that we're not, you know, we don't really know the answer for is that every district is facing fiscal pressure right now. And so there's sort of two ways you can address that. I mean, you can find efficiencies in the school district and try to get at your costs by increased efficiencies. And if you can't find those efficiencies or those efficiencies aren't there, then to some extent you have to go after the output that you have, the quality of the educational product that you're providing. And so even for districts that maybe are balancing their budget every year, have they reached a point where they are no longer able to find additional efficiencies or struggling or finding it harder and harder to find ways to save money in the face of diminishing resources? And so even though their budget is balanced and they're not needing an emergency loan from the state, is it impacting their ability to provide educational services? And are we going to see the quality of the education product that we're putting out in the state, basically, how well are we educating our K-12 students, start to decline?
Yeah, when you think of, for example, a school district like Benton Harbor, where the superintendent there told our West Michigan reporter, Lindsay Smith, look, we have cut and cut again. They have closed schools. They cut teacher pay. They privatized services. They have classrooms with 40 or 50 students. So they've done all of that. What is left?
Right. I mean, it's an interesting question for Michigan. So Michigan, up until just recently, was a fairly high-spending state when you compared it nationally. As recently as 10 years ago, we were in the top 10 among states. And I think there was a little bit of a perception that Michigan spent a lot of money and we weren't necessarily seeing the results in our output because we didn't rank as highly on our test scores and other metrics. But we have rapidly fallen in those rankings, and now we're about the 25th ranked state. And we used to spend, you know, 117, 120% of the national average per pupil, and now we're just slightly below the national average. We're very close to the national average. So we've seen sort of where we stand compared to other states fall. At the same time, we've seen how we do on some national tests fall over the period. Now, those could be completely unrelated. I mean, correlation does not imply causation.
Mm-hmm.
But it is certainly something to be concerned about is to what extent, or if any, are the declines that we're seeing in things like our NAEP ranking compared to other states related to the declines that we see in how we rank compared to other states in the school funding? And I mean, unfortunately, the answer is we don't know the answer to that question, but it's certainly something to be concerned about.
And now that this pot of emergency money is basically tapped out, what now? What do schools do now?
For emergency loans, I mean, the state can always come up with additional funds for that. So it's not so much a problem coming up with the additional resources. The money they appropriate is sort of comes out of the state's common cash that they would be investing anyway, and instead they lend the money to the schools, and that loan becomes an investment. So they can come up with more than that. So it's not so much that fund is running low that's the concern. The concern is that we have to keep tapping that fund,
mm-hmm.
is that it's a sign that additional districts are finding themselves in distress. So, I mean, I don't think we should worry about does the fund have enough money in it, because, you know, it's not such a big number that the state will have any problems filling it. The concern is, you know, why are we continuing to go back to the fund, and what does that say about the health of the fiscal health of the state school districts?
Well, what are some things lawmakers could be talking about right now in terms of other ways to help struggling school districts?
You know, one of the things that I think the state probably needs to be thoughtful about is how do you best find economies of scale for school districts, and is there an optimal number of school districts? So on the one hand, we've heard the state superintendent talk about trying to have all the school districts in a county, you know, share their back office services and try to make stuff like that happen. And and there's been a little bit of a suggestion along with that the state has too many school districts and, you know, that the number's too high. But at the same time that we're doing that, we are dramatically expanding the number of school districts in the state as we continue to add new districts and new charter schools. I mean, every new charter school that we add is a new district. And so what is the sweet spot there between having additional educational offerings that charter schools provide, but at the same time being able to capture economies of scale from providing services? I think the other thing that would really be helpful for school districts is for state policymakers to really take a look at the school aid formulas and try to figure out if they work well in situations of declining enrollment. So right now we see a situation where your costs, when you lose a student, don't fall as much as your revenues decline for various reasons. You have a lot of fixed costs as a school district. Just because you lose one child from every classroom doesn't mean you can close any buildings or lay off any teachers.
Right.
And so this disconnect, well, that disconnect, the positive thing it does is it makes districts very anxious to have new students because they bring in more revenue than they cost. And so we see a lot of competition for students, and it causes school districts to really try to, you know, be their best and attract students in. But at the same time, like I say, when you lose students, it puts really big fiscal pressure on you. And given that state enrollment is declining for demographic reasons and that two-thirds of our districts are losing kids right now, they're not really losing kids because they're not competing well. They're sort of losing kids because there just aren't enough kids. And I think we really need to go back and look at, okay, if all of our districts are going to be losing kids or a good chunk of them, how should the formulas adjust to that decline so that school districts, as they start to lose kids, don't immediately find themselves in some sort of severe fiscal situation? The other thing the governor proposed that's noteworthy is establishing people who is sort of an early warning system, things that school districts need to do to report their financial results, and then employees in the Michigan Department of Treasury and Department of Ed who are going to be charged with monitoring the finances of districts to try and catch problems before the districts find themselves in financial emergencies so that maybe they can take earlier action and avoid a future crisis.
And that's in the works now,
yes.
Going through that.
It was in the governor's proposal, yes.
Jeff Guilfoyle with Public Sector Consultants. Appreciate your insights and your explanations. Good talking with you, Jeff.
Good talking to you. Thanks.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. One of the longest-lasting, durable brands on the store shelves of America is Gerber.
The state of Michigan.
Ensuring quality products today.
Its Michigan roots have been strong right from the beginning in the town of Fremont. We're joined now by Aileen Stocks of Gerber. Welcome to the program, Aileen.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tell us about Dorothy and Dan Gerber and their baby daughter, Sally.
As you mentioned, it started with Dorothy and Dan Gerber. It was born out of her concern for her daughter, Sally. She had a progressive pediatrician at the time, and he recommended that she introduce strained foods to Sally. So like any good mother, she went about peeling, steaming, straining vegetables. And if you've ever tried that, it's fun maybe once.
Right.
It's a lot of work. So, seeing that Dan had a canning company, she actually recommended to him that he produce the baby food. So in 1928, Dan Gerber produced the first commercially produced baby food.
I can only imagine the conversation where she's working away at the sink and he's making comments in the background, and she could have turned and said, all right, you do it.
And you know what? It's funny because one of the family members actually recounts the story that way, that she threw the strainer at him and said, if you could do it better, do it. And he did.
And even though Gerber was bought by Nestle in 2007, it has stayed true to its Michigan roots.
Absolutely. And we're really proud of our Michigan roots. So the Fremont plant is where, the first varieties were produced. It's the original home of Gerber, and we still produce there today.
I have to wonder, was Sally Gerber the inspiration for the iconic Gerber baby?
Actually, it all started with a photo contest. So they wanted a photo to represent the Gerber baby. So it actually is Ann Turner Cook. It's a drawing that was submitted as part of a contest. So the inspiration, obviously, absolutely, was Sally. Mm-hmm. But the actual face is a woman named Ann Turner Cook.
And it really is all from a West Michigan mother who was trying to do her best to follow her baby's pediatrician's advice.
Yes, absolutely.
Aileen Sparks of Gerber, thank you so much for talking with us. Great Michigan story.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Changes are happening in the way that we've relied on cars and trucks to get us where we want and need to go. Could people really manage without cars? Mickey Maynard has founded a new journalism project. It's called Curbing Cars. Part of this project is her new ebook, Curbing Cars, America's Independence from the Auto Industry, just published by Forbes. Mickey, welcome back to Stateside.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks a lot, Cindy.
You have covered the auto industry for so many years, including doing a stint as the Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times. So you know the auto industry. You know autos. What has led you to feel that America's love affair with the car is on the wane?
I first noticed this about 6 years ago when I was speaking with my 16-year-old nephew, 16 at the time, and I said, oh, have you gotten your driver's license? And he said, no, I don't have time. And I started to ask other children of friends, are your kids getting your licenses? And they said, no, we can't understand why they aren't getting them. And so I wrote a story for the Times then that's turned out that only about 28% of 16-year-olds were getting their licenses. The number has since dropped. And what we're seeing at the same time is that overall driving has dropped. And it's especially dropping among these folks who were born after 1980.
And what do you think is behind that?
Couple of things. First of all, social trends. So especially with the younger people, they don't need to get together as much as they once did. You don't have to see your friends in person. You can see them on the screen of your mobile device. They're very, very busy. They're overloaded with schoolwork, with their sports and their music and things like that. It's also expensive now to get a driver's license. We could go to our public school driver's ed program. Mm-hmm. Many, many school districts have eliminated driver's ed, and it costs $300 or more to get a license. And then another thing among other folks is that the social trends have changed. So you have about 30 million people in the U.S. who are able to work from home at least one day a week. You have the growth in public transportation. You have a renewed interest in bicycling, and you have some interest in the environment, too. So if you add all that up, driving across the country is down about 8% the past decade.
So when we look at this, you wonder, in fact, I noticed you wrote a piece about this for the Columbia Journalism Review, and it seemed to me you were kind of taking journalists to task for what? Missing on these signs that you feel are showing that we're rethinking our dependence on autos? Are they being too rah-rah cheerleaders for the automakers?
Oh, no, I don't think it's a case of being too rah-rah cheermaker, because if you think about Michigan in particular, the auto industry is hugely important to the state's economy. But what I think is happening is this is happening incrementally, just a little bit at a time across society. And journalism is usually divided into beats. So the auto writers are not paying attention to people on bicycles. And the urban writers or the transportation writers aren't looking at the auto industry. They're looking at buses and subways and streetcars. So it's one of those stories that you have to have a 50,000-foot view, and you can't really see it just by covering one piece of it.
What does this look like in the day-to-day life of people in America, Mickey?
So there are still going to be many, many people who depend on their automobile. But if you think about it, the average automobile commute in America is about 25 minutes and one person is in the car. So folks who have the option of taking public transportation, if you live in Ann Arbor, if you live in Chicago, if you live in a big city like New York or even Lansing, you have the ability to take the bus or in New York, the subway. In Chicago, you have the L. And what is happening is as the Obama administration saved the two Detroit car companies, General Motors and Chrysler, mm-hmm. it also quietly spent billions of dollars on new transportation systems, things like protected bike lanes and others across the country. So it's kind of like the Obama administration made two bets, one on Detroit and one on everything else.
We're seeing certainly the light rail systems being upgraded.
Yeah.
Part of that, too. But it's interesting. Your piece in the Columbia Journalism Review kind of spelling out these views. There were a lot of reader comments, so people are clearly really interested in this topic. A number of people were kind of accusing you of using anecdotes to support this point of view that you really believe in. Are there statistics that really support this view that we're cooling on our cars?
Well, yes, we have a number of statistics that we talk about in the ebook, and the University of Michigan has been a center for research on this. You've had U of M looking at why people are driving less and why teenagers are not getting your licenses. You have some advocacy groups like US Purge who are measuring the same thing. You have the Federal Highway System, which is certainly measuring what's going on. So if you need statistics on this, you can definitely find them.
Well, I will say I kind of did some digging and I found that according to the U.S. Department of Transportation, of the more than 128 million commuters in the U.S., nearly 76% are driving alone. You've got 2.52% taking the bus. So looking at that, can you understand why a lot of people find it very hard to wrap their minds around this view that we're rethinking our dependence on autos? Because it sure feels like we still are.
Absolutely. But you have to think about this. You know, the automobile has only been a part of American life for about 100 years. So before 1900, nobody had a car. The auto industry's dominance in this country is only kind of a recent phenomenon. So Kevin Boyle, who is a professor at Northwestern University and who's from Detroit, said that we are now shifting back to where we were before 1900 mentally. The automobile was supposed to be our independence. Now a lot of people see it as not independence, the opposite of that, because you have payments, you have gas, you have insurance, you have parking in a big city, and they're starting, especially the recession made people look at what they were actually spending. And one of the big areas where people saw they could cut back was a car. But it wasn't just the recession, because if it was just the recession, the drop in driving would have rebounded by now. So I'm saying that it's both financial but also social, and the fact that there are options now besides cars is making people rethink the way they get around.
Although I would say, unlike the 19th century when people did live in cities, you're seeing some movement, baby boomers, younger hipsters moving into the cities, but a lot of folks are really entrenched out there where you don't really have a choice. You've got to drive.
Right. But that's their choice to be where they are. And so as they're able to move into cities, and some of it's happening in Detroit, but it's happening in smaller cities too. There's a great demand for places to live in downtown Ann Arbor. People in Lansing want to live along that Michigan Avenue corridor. That's one of the most heavily trafficked bus routes in the entire state, from the state capital to the East Lansing campus of Michigan State. So when you have the option, and it isn't every single day, there are some people that drive to work, you know, 4 days a week, but one day a week they have the time to take a bus. Or the one person in the household who needs the car uses the car, and the other person in the household takes the bus, that sort of thing.
Yeah, so, you call that driving light.
I call it driving light. And the term essentially means that you look at how you're going to use your, you know, your family fleet. I can certainly remember a time when if you had two adults and two teens or two 20-somethings that every single person had a car, but we're seeing that start to decline. And this isn't the kind of thing that changes overnight. It's the kind of thing that will happen over a decade to two decades to three decades. But I'm betting we have this conversation, say, 10 years from now,
mm-hmm.
you might say to me, Mickey, how did this all happen? And what I'm saying is we can see it starting to happen now.
So then what are the challenges for the auto industry?
Right. So the auto industry faces a couple of challenges. First of all, the young people that they count on to come in and start buying cars are putting off car purchases. It doesn't mean that they will never buy a car. But if the average person wanted to buy a car after they graduated college, and now they're waiting until they're 30 or even 35 when they get married and have their kids, that means that that's time lost to the auto industry. At the other end of it, baby boomers are starting to spend less on automobiles. We have some interesting numbers in the book that show that the amount that people in the baby boom generation are spending has dropped significantly. And that's a surprise because the auto industry thought the boomers would just keep doing what they were doing. So they have to do a couple things. They have to get younger people into cars. Every vehicle that they sell needs to be more profitable than it used to be, because if you're going to sell fewer vehicles, you know, you can't make it up on volume anymore. Mm. You have to make it up on profit. So one of the things we'll see with cars is a lot more technology loaded into cars for two reasons. One, to make money. Two, so that if you have technology in the cars, maybe that will appeal to the younger buyers who are so technology focused. And then another thing I think the auto industry needs to do is acknowledge that this is happening and partner with some of these new alternatives. So I believe we're seeing Honda and Zipcar partnering. We haven't yet seen a car company sponsor a bike sharing program, but eventually I think a car company will sponsor a bike sharing program. And that they call this greenwashing, you know, improving your image by being environmentally friendly. But I do think that there's sort of a natural tie someday between a car company and a bike program, because, you know, most people who use bike sharing also own cars, and most people who use something like Zipcar also own a car. So there is a bridge that could be built between the auto industry and these new forms of transportation.
It also sounds like urban planners and architects, and there's got to be some awareness of this as going forward.
Yes. The whole urban planning and transportation planning world is absolutely fascinated by this. And one of the interesting things that's going on in urban planning is something called placemaking, which is that you don't build big edifices anymore as a way to draw people into cities. You do littler things on the ground. You fix up a park. You have a festival. You build a fake beach for the summer. And that way you draw folks into the city. And the thinking is, they'll come into the city to go see your place, and then they might do a couple of other things while they're in the city. And if you have public transportation, they could still drive in, but they might park and then ride around while they're in the city. So these urban planners and architects are looking at how do you marry new kinds of transportation with the kind of things that they're known for doing.
What are you hoping might come from the site, from Curbing Cars, and from your ebook?
Well, one of our goals is to basically say, look, you know, we know America was a car-focused country, but if you look around the world, people come back from Denmark and Sweden and Paris and Rome and say, people are riding bicycles, you know, they're using public transportation. We're way behind the rest of the world in building things like high-speed rail and protected bike lanes and stuff like that. So what I'd like people to do is, first of all, be aware that this alternative conversation to total car dependence is going on. I would like this to maybe spur some discussion in cities that are thinking about adding a bike sharing program. For instance, we've seen bike sharing in Lansing. It's coming in Ann Arbor, and it may eventually come in Detroit. So I want folks to know what's this all about. And I think another thing is that this is a country where we are much more diverse and we have much more interesting points of view than just the old box that everybody went, you know, grew up, got a job, bought a house, and bought a car. I think now folks are looking strategically at transportation, and I just want to be the person that points that out.
Mickey Maynard's ebook is Curbing Cars, America's Independence from the Auto Industry, just published by Forbes. And she's founder and editor of Curbing Cars. The website is curbingcars.com. And, of course, they're on Facebook and on Twitter at Curbing Cars. Mickey, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Cindy.
It's one of the most authentic urban experiences in the country, Detroit's Eastern Market. These days, the Eastern Market is a six-block area just east of downtown Detroit. It's been feeding people since 1891. But there is a much longer history of public markets in Detroit. Food historian Bill Loomis wrote about this for Michigan History Magazine. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Cindy.
So these six blocks that we know as the Eastern Market, this has been a process of evolution. It wasn't the first site of a public market in Detroit.
No, absolutely. Some of the earliest sites were between Jefferson and the river up until 1848. That was where almost everything occurred.
And was it much like, I mean, today, even now, Saturday is the big day to shop at the Eastern Market.
Yep.
Was it that way, say, in 1843?
It was. It was that way. It was the same thing. Everybody get ready on Friday night and save their good stuff for all the shoppers that came in on Saturday.
And the idea was still the same thing, too? Fresh food at a good price?
That was it. You could save a penny or two. And as ethnic groups came into the city, they would pick different days to shop. So the stall keepers knew what the Hungarians liked to eat, so they made sure they had stuff on sale that appealed to them, stuff like that.
Okay. And there was actually a baby buggy ban?
There was. This was the days before shopping carts. And you think, well, how did people carry it? Well, they used baby buggies. And they would take the baby buggies. But the problem was there were so many.
Minus the baby.
Yeah, minus the baby. There were so many of them. There was actual gridlock. The board of directors of the market said, no more baby buggies without a baby. So then, you know, the women say, well, I need to borrow your baby, too. So they would have babies in there with them. And it was cute. The paper described it. There, all of a sudden, a little head would poke out among the cabbages.
Now, there was something that as I read your piece on it, I called the Great Cucumber Food Fight.
Oh.
Tell us about the big food fight. When when and why?
Well, that was the they call them Dutch, but they were really Germans. Detroiters called Germans Dutch.
Mm-hmm.
And one particular woman had a cartload of cucumbers, and there were some pretty feisty people there. A couple of Irish man and woman didn't like the attitude, so they got into a fight and started throwing cucumbers and beets. And then the whole place broke out in this big vegetable fight. I guess it was a bloody mess, you know.
John Belushi would have been proud. Now, when did electricity come to the market?
Yeah, the first markets were lit with what were called penny candles. And those were then replaced with gas. Mm. And then I think the electric lights came in right around the turn of the century, 1910, sometime around then.
So how did the market migrate over to the site we are all familiar with today, just east of downtown?
Well, it began as a wood market and a hay market. And so then there was development in the center. There was the Eastern Market and the Western Market and then the Central Market. And the Central Market was for more of the classier customers.
Mm-hmm.
It was big and it was the place to be. But they moved that when they wanted to develop the market.
The plum market of its day?
Yeah, there
okay.
you go.
All right.
When they wanted to develop downtown more. It was this big sprawling thing. You can imagine on a Saturday, there might have been 40,000 horses and people. So you can imagine the mess and other considerations. So they just said, we need to get this out of downtown. This is not doing us right. So that's when they moved it over.
And that was, I guess, I saw on their website, according to the Eastern Market website, 1891, they've been feeding Detroiters.
I think that's right. I think it was, 1891. And it was, it's been a lot of other things there as well. It's very interesting to take a tour there. If anybody's down there, Preservation Wayne or Preservation Detroit.
Okay.
And it's really fun.
It would be fun. And I think that there are legions of folks that not only grew up shopping there, but grew up working there. And in fact, I used to work with a fellow whose father had a food and fruit and vegetable business down there, and he said he'll tell everybody he went to EMU, Eastern Market University, because he said everybody else is sleeping in on a you know, summer morning.
Yeah, right.
Off of college, he said I was up at 4 on the truck delivering. So there's a quite a lot of stories to be told.
I bet there is.
Historian Bill Loomis with a look back at the history of Detroit's Eastern Market. Thanks so much, Bill.
Sure, Cindy.
Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark, and our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors today are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Chris Hattelsey, Megha Satyanarayana, Omar Sadeh, Katie Suha, and Jeff Warniak. Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation and the Ford Foundation. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening. We'll